This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
Donald Trump announces his Supreme Court pick. We talk about who Brett Kavanaugh is and what that will mean for the court. We go there now on Tactics. Welcome into Tactics. You're listening to us on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com, 860-1440. That's the way to get in touch with us. If you have a deep, abiding desire to do so, we certainly do encourage that. If you want to get into the program, talk to us about exactly what is happening, what is going on, you are always welcome to do that at 860-1440, or you can always tweet me at Tactics Radio. By the way, last night's event, which we are of course about to break down here in just a second, went pretty well on Twitter. We actually went out and I was live tweeting the whole thing, giving my thoughts, got a lot of feedback, got a lot of comments, and I do want to talk about that this morning. There were a lot of people, regulars on the show, that gave some commentary on that, so always appreciate having that sort of audience interaction. But the big event, of course, last night when Donald Trump announced that Brett Kavanaugh would be his choice for the Supreme Court of the United States to fill Justice Kennedy's seat. And just a handful of statistics, I guess you would say, if you're a baseball guy, on Brett Kavanaugh. First of all, his resume, he's got a very, very long resume. This guy is very qualified for the job. A lot of prestige behind his name. He is currently serving as a justice on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which in a lot of people regard as the most prestigious court of appeals. Also, the guy is 53, which is something that I know that the Trump administration was certainly looking for. They were looking for somebody who was younger who would be able to serve on the court for a number of years. He's a little older than I actually thought they were going to go. I thought one thing that would play into their decision is that they would probably try to get somebody that was at least a little bit younger. I thought that they might go with Amy Barrett, who's about 45, and that was actually my first choice. Well, not my first choice. She was my first choice on the original five-person shortlist. Of course, my first choice was Thomas Lee, as I've said many times. But anyway, he's a little bit older than several of the other candidates, but 53 still. I mean, you could wind up on the Supreme Court easily. I don't think that it would be a surprise to anybody if he winds up staying on the court for another 30 years. And so, if confirmed, Brett Kavanaugh could serve on the Supreme Court of the United States for a very long time. And with that in mind, it is important to remember that when it comes to Brett Kavanaugh, there is a good chance, a very good chance, that he will be on the court for a number of decades, if confirmed. That will certainly lengthen Trump's legacy if he has Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. I mean, even if he winds up not getting elected for whatever reason in 2020, his legacy will already have a very long arm if the two of those stay on the court for quite some time. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the event itself before we get into Brett Kavanaugh. Look, like Trump or hate Trump, the guy's a showman. Like this decision or not like this decision, you have to appreciate the fact that this thing has been really turned into a show. Typically, announcements like this are made by presidents. They're made in the middle of the day. But Trump has to turn everything into an event. This, I guess, comes from his background as being the host of The Apprentice. And, I mean, the guy's just so immaculate and elaborate when it comes to everything. He has to have the biggest, the best. He has to have the greatest everything. And so he really does turn this whole thing into a show, which I thought was very satisfying and entertaining, to say the least, the way that there's this sort of primetime feel. He puts it right in the middle of primetime. And one thing that was funny that I noticed while I was tweeting last night is apparently, and I didn't know this because I have never even seen an episode of The Bachelor or The Bachelorette, but apparently The Bachelorette was airing last night then it was going on. So I saw that the hashtag was trending right alongside the SCOTUS pick hashtag, and I checked it out just to see what people were talking about, which was incredibly funny because apparently the network, I don't even know what network it's on, whichever network it is that airs The Bachelorette, they broke into their regularly scheduled program and interrupted the show to have the Supreme Court pick, and there were so many people, I'm guessing mostly house moms, that were really distraught that The Bachelorette was being interrupted by Trump. And so it was really funny. But I'm sitting there thinking, come on, people. This is a decision that could affect your life for the next 30 years. And you're not willing to take 5-10 minutes out of your precious little reality TV show that you're not even going to remember the names of any of these people next year to see how that's going to unfold and take a minute to look it up. Look, I know I'm a geek. I know that I'm a nerd when it comes to this kind of stuff, but I would think that even the average person would realize the significance and the clout of it and not mind their show being interrupted for something this important. But I guess that's too much to ask of the average American. Anyway, but one thing that I did think was funny about that and ironic about the whole thing is that if you think about it, Trump's selection felt very much like The Bachelor or The Bachelorette. You have these 5 or 6 candidates that was whittled down from a list of 25, and we've been talking about them back and forth. Does this person make a good fit for Trump? Is Trump going to be able to trust this person? All this stuff. And then finally last night, it was Brett Kavanaugh that got the rose. He is the bachelor's choice, I guess. And so he will be going forward to the Senate to be vetted and eventually confirmed, possibly, depending on how the votes are going to shake out, and we'll talk about whether or not he has a chance of getting confirmed. But here's really my takeaway from the whole thing. When it comes to Brett Kavanaugh, he was by absolutely no means my first choice. In fact, he was close to my last out of the short list. So out of that last list of, I think it wound up finally being 6, because he had his original shortlist of 5 and then threw Mike Lee in there. And so that was 6. And out of all of them, I think I had Hardiman dead last and Kavanaugh right next to last. So certainly not my first choice, not my pick. I'm very glad that it was not Hardiman, because I was actually very much afraid that Hardiman was going to be the person that wound up getting the nomination. But thankfully that did not happen. But here's the thing. He was not my first choice, but he's not a bad choice. I don't understand why we wouldn't go more conservative. A lot of people are saying, well, it was a compromise pick, and he wanted to get somebody that would be easier to be confirmed. But here's the thing. We have a majority in the Senate, and we have a Republican majority in the Senate, which means that we should go as conservative as humanly possible, and then, if that doesn't work out, if the nominee doesn't get confirmed, then you might consider going moderate, but you don't start out going moderate. I mean, that would be like in a negotiation to buy a used car. You start out at $5,000 more than you're willing to pay when you're negotiating. Well, don't start there. Start arguing under. I mean, that makes sense to me. Then you might have to work your way up and pay a little more than you wanted to, but at least for, if nothing else, just to try to get a good deal, start under. And that's the same thing that I would recommend with Trump, because there's plenty of time between now and the midterm elections. It would not be much of a stretch to, if the first nominee winds up not panning out, to go to another nominee. That would not be a huge deal. And so I don't understand why you don't go more conservative. My buddy Chris, who has been on this program a number of times, you remember he's one of the nerd herd. He comes in and talks to us every now and then. He actually gave a really good analogy about Brett Kavanaugh. He sent me a text this morning and said, you know what? I really did figure out a good analogy for Kavanaugh. It's like your friend invites you over to their house for ice cream, and then you get there and all they have is plain vanilla. I mean, that's a very apt description, because you're happy to get the ice cream. It's not that you don't like vanilla. It's just you were thinking, well, you know, maybe I'll get chocolate or one of the specialty flavors. Maybe I'll get some moose tracks. Maybe there will be some chocolate syrup there or something like that. No, just plain vanilla. That's all you got. And so you're still happy to get the pick. You're still happy with Kavanaugh. but you're certainly aware of the fact that there were better options out there. And so that's a really good analogy. I appreciate Chris for coming up with that. Usually I'm the guy that comes up with all the analogies, but good job on that one. I think that is a very good description of the way a lot of people are feeling, especially conservatives like myself, are feeling about Kavanaugh. Now, Neil Gorsuch is a hot fudge sundae with the works. I mean, he's got everything. That was everything we were hoping for, everything we expected. Kavanaugh, not so much. Kavanaugh, there are some definite red flags. There's definitely some downsides to him. I think if we're looking at how conservative he will be, how originalist he will be, I think that he falls somewhere between Alito and Roberts. So of the conservatives, I think you've got your most conservative, least conservative. Most conservative is your Judge Thomas, and then you've got Neil Gorsuch. After him, Samuel Alito. And then I think you're probably going to have Kavanaugh, and then Roberts. And so I think that Kavanaugh is going to be slightly more conservative than John Roberts, and part of that we're going to get into in a second about some of his criticism of Obamacare. So slightly more conservative than Roberts, but not quite as conservative as Alito. So again, not a bad pick, certainly an improvement over Kennedy if he winds up replacing Kennedy, but still not exactly what I would say would be a good would have been my first pick by any stretch of the imagination. So I just think we could have done better. I'm not trying to gripe. I'm not trying to be downtrodden or anything like that. Being able to replace Justice Kennedy is still a big deal. It's still going to be an improvement. I just wish it was more of an improvement. So what do you think about this? Do you like Brett Kavanaugh? Do you think he's going to be a good pick? What'd you think about his speech last night? Be happy to hear any of those opinions. By the way, great speech last night. If he'll actually stick to what he was saying the other night, I will 100% support Kavanaugh. And actually, if he sticks to the things that he actually said he would do last night, he'll probably be even more conservative than I'm letting on that he will be. But, you know, we can only hope. We'll see what happens. 860-1440 if you want to call in. We'll be back in just a moment.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The name of the Lord, says the scripture, is a strong tower. Thither the righteous flee and are safe. Let us secure his favor, and he will lead us through the journey of this life and, at length, receive us to a better. Samuel Adams.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com, 860-1440. That's the way to get in touch with us if you want to do so. You're also welcome to tweet at Tactics Radio if you'd rather do that. So we're talking about the pick for the Supreme Court by President Trump, and that will be Judge Brett Kavanaugh of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. Now, I do want to go through a list of pros and cons and explain those, hopefully. First of all, I do want to start off positive because I've been very critical of Brett Kavanaugh, especially in my observation looking at all of the candidates, and I had a good reason for doing so. He was, I thought, the least strong out of all the candidates, with the exception of Thomas Hardiman. So I do want to start out positive. I wanted to talk about the things that I think he's really good at and the decisions I think that he'll make that he will be a solid voice for the Constitution on. So when it comes to the pros, he is very critical of federal overreach. So this is something that he has a reputation of being against, that he doesn't like the idea of the Fed getting involved in things like business. He doesn't like the Fed getting involved in things like regulation or abridging the states' rights. So that's something that he's been pretty strong on. Now, we don't have as many decisions on when it comes to states' rights on the 10th Amendment, just because he's in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which meant the issue of statehood didn't come up quite as often as him. Now, we have a very extensive body of work when it comes to Brett Kavanaugh. He has authored, he's been on the court for, I think, 12 years now, and he has authored 300 different opinions where he's either agreed with the court or offered a dissent. And so we've got a pretty good handle on the kind of judge that he will be. This guy is not an enigma. He is not somebody that is an unknown, which was my biggest gripe with Kethledge. The problem with Kethledge is that even though he seemed very conservative, he gave a lot of lip service to originalism and textualism, and he may very well wind up being one of our better justices, is that he was just too much of an unknown. We didn't know very much about him. Amy Barrett had that problem to a lesser extent. She had more time on the court. We knew more about her. We just didn't know enough. And so one thing that you cannot say when it comes to Trump's pick, Kavanaugh, is that we just don't know enough about him. This guy is very well established. We know exactly where he stands, and there's some good and bad to that. And one thing that I would say he does very well on is he's critical of federal overreach. And so that's something that we have a pretty good handle on. The states' rights things we don't have as much of a handle on just because of where his decisions were made, which would not have involved states' rights quite as often. He's also solidly against Chevron deference. And I know a lot of you that don't speak Latin and don't have a law degree, like myself, are sitting there thinking, what on earth is Chevron deference? So Chevron deference is really important, and this has to do with the separation of powers specifically, because Chevron deference is the idea that certain agencies, because they have some expertise in an area, that they will be granted some kind of quasi-judicial powers. Actually, this was my single biggest gripe with Antonin Scalia. Now, Scalia was a phenomenal justice, and I think that he may be one of the most impactful justices of my time. Even though I like Thomas better, you know, when it comes to this, Scalia, because of his opinions and the way that he wrote, is probably a more impactful justice. But anyway, I say all that to say that when it comes to Justice Scalia, he was a little more iffy on the Chevron deference thing. He seemed to think that it was okay. One thing that I do like about Kavanaugh is that he doesn't seem to be a fan of Chevron deference at all. And so he does not like these agencies having these sort of phony courts. And there's a couple reasons why you can see why that would be a problem. First of all, they are part of the executive branch and not the judiciary. And so they obviously should not have any judicial powers whatsoever because they're not a member of the judicial branch. That's a place for the federal courts. That is the executive branch sort of spilling over into the territory of the judiciary, which is not a good idea. And another thing that you have a problem with, because this is sort of the idea that, for example, let's say that all of a sudden you have a really big puddle in your backyard and the EPA finds out about it and they deem that all of a sudden as navigable waters, which, by the way, this has happened. I'm not just making this stuff up. This is something that actually could happen. So the EPA comes in and says, nope, that puddle is big enough. It qualifies as a navigable water. And so let's say you want to put a pool in there. They say, nope, can't do it. That's going to be destroying wetland. And you can't do that because of the environmental impact, even though it's in your own backyard. Or you say, I want to plant some, I don't know, some sunflowers or whatever it is that you want to plant. And they say, nope, can't do that. You can't farm on that land. That's considered a wetland. That is a navigable water, and you'll be in violation of the Clean Water Act if you do anything to that land. Well, it basically makes your backyard completely worthless, and you could argue it's ridiculous that they're not allowing you to do so. Well, where do you appeal that? You would think you would appeal it in some kind of federal court. But the problem with that is that, according to Chevron deference, they would say, the people that are advocates for Chevron deference would say, well, the EPA, they're really the experts in this, and so we're going to let them decide exactly how this is going to happen. You're going to have to appeal directly to the EPA. So you can see how this would be a really huge problem. First of all, the EPA should not be deciding things that a court should decide. But second of all, and this is more important, the EPA is making a ruling on whether or not the EPA was right or not. It's kind of like that episode of Friends where Phoebe and Joey are having the race between the chicken and the duck, and Joey is a participant in the race. He's the one that bet on the duck, and he's also the referee. It would be kind of like if Gus Malzahn hired the referees for all the games at Auburn, and they were directly on his payroll. You can see why that would be a problem, and there would be some issues of impartiality that would come up with that. The EPA would essentially be ruling on itself whether or not the EPA acted correctly or not and finding difference in the two. Or, you know, to give another analogy, it's kind of like, even though I think that this was really funny when he would do this, there would be times where on the Andy Griffith show that Andy Griffith would bring somebody in and try to put them in jail because he's the sheriff, and they'd say that they wanted to appeal to the justice of the peace, and then he would turn the little sign on his desk around to say justice of the peace. So essentially, Andy was the arresting officer, but he was also the judge that decided whether the arresting officer acted correctly. And you can see why there's not much of an appeal process there because of that, which was really funny. But in the EPA's case, this can really destroy people's lives. And I'm just using the EPA as an example. There are other organizations within the executive branch, like the ATF, so on and so forth, that could allegedly, based on Chevron deference, have these kind of quasi-judicial powers. And that's not a good idea. I really do applaud that Kavanaugh seems to be an outspoken critic of that. He's also very good on separation of powers. Chevron deference is a part of that. He wants the separation of powers that are defined in the Constitution. He doesn't seem to like the judiciary overreaching into the realm of legislation or executive power, and the same could be said for the executive branch overreaching into the judiciary or overreaching into the powers of the legislature. He seems to be very good at separation of powers. He understands that the president and the judiciary are not supposed to make laws. And you would say, well, that should be basic stuff for every Supreme Court justice. Yes, you would think so, but that's not the case. And unfortunately, there are a number of people, including Justice Roberts, that seems to not understand that it's the legislature that's supposed to be making the laws, not everybody else. So he seems pretty good on separation of powers as defined by the Constitution. He is very strong on gun rights. There was a ban on semi-automatic weapons in the D.C. area that he wrote a dissent on. He said that any kind of ban on semi-automatic weapons is unconstitutional, so he seems to be really good when it comes to gun rights. He also seems to be mostly against government regulation. It appears, based on what I'm seeing, that he's not a big fan of government regulation, so that is another point in his favor. He ruled against consumer finance protection, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which, by the way, was a part of Dodd-Frank. So that's part of the reason I'm saying that it looks like he is primarily against government regulation and rules in favor of individual economic liberty. And one thing that he has been talked about a lot, at least over the past 24 hours, is he openly praised the original dissent in Roe v. Wade. So he gave this speech a number of years ago, and in that speech, he was talking about Roe v. Wade and openly praised the dissent of one of the justices in Roe v. Wade, talking about how much he liked it, which seems to be, and I say seems to be, because we're still looking into this, and it'll, you know, we won't know until he's actually on the court and making decisions on this. So it'll be a long time before we actually know about this. And it seems that he is strong on pro-life just based on that alone. There's some other reasons that give me some concern, and we'll get to that in a second. But based on that, if he is giving praise to the dissent of Roe v. Wade, that seems to suggest that he does not like the case Roe v. Wade and how it turned out. He seems to favor the dissent more than the decision, which is written, which, by the way, he should. It's a terribly written decision. It's a terribly written document when it comes to the Supreme Court. The opinion that was authored was filled with inconsistencies, and they basically invented a brand new right to privacy completely out of whole cloth. So there's a number of reasons, even if you happen to be pro-abortion, to think that Roe v. Wade is a terrible Supreme Court decision from a legal standpoint. So that's just something that we're hoping means that he will be a strong advocate for pro-life. He will be a strong voice for the constitutional protections afforded by the Constitution to those who are unborn. And there's a number of cons as well, things that give me pause and concern about Kavanaugh. We'll talk about those in just a second. 860-1440.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
Hebrews 8:10. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, says the Lord, I will put my laws into their minds, and I will write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 is the way to get in touch with us. Of course, the huge breaking news from last night is the Supreme Court nomination of Donald Trump. We're going to be breaking this down for the majority, if not all of the morning. And one of the things that I wanted to let you know is that we're supposed to have Ben Dupree, who in my mind is one of the sharpest legal minds in the state of Alabama. He was a staff attorney for the Alabama Supreme Court. He will be in here at 10 a.m. And I'm very much looking forward to the conversation that we can have with him. Ben is somebody that I really like, somebody that I trust. He is a good conservative when it comes to all of this stuff, and he knows this stuff like the back of his hand. So really looking forward to getting his opinions and hearing what he has to say about the president's pick. That being said, there are some things that I am worried about with Brett Kavanaugh. I think that he is overall a good pick, but he's not a bad pick, but he's certainly not the best pick that was possible. So a couple of the disadvantages that Brett Kavanaugh is going to have. First of all, the guy's a swamp person. I mean, he has been in with the Bushes. He has been in D.C. for the past 12 years. He worked with George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. He was, you know, intrinsic and entrenched in both of their tenures there, and he was working with them. So the guy is a D.C. swamp person. He's an establishment figure. Now, I don't think that that's necessarily absolutely beyond the shadow of a doubt something that means that they are discredited and there's no redeeming them whatsoever from then on out. But it is something that I do think ought to bring at least some concern. So the guy is definitely an establishment guy. He's also known for working across the aisle, kind of like John Roberts. And a lot of people, the most comparisons that I was hearing last night, and this comes from both the left and the right, is that he is absolutely... The person that he is most similar to is John Roberts. And because of that and because of how that tends to play out, I don't think that a lot of conservatives are going to be happy with that, because we didn't need another Roberts. We needed another Gorsuch. We needed another Justice Thomas. And so this guy, who is known for working across the aisle, you know, air fingers quotes there, I just see that that's going to wind up hurting us later on, because he does have that idea and he seems to, like Roberts, want some, at least some measure of agreement amongst the justices. Roberts is very much concerned about his image. He's concerned about making the court look good. He wants as many people on the court to agree on decisions as possible. And because of that, he tends to favor very narrow decisions that are not bold, that do not out and out state their opinions on things, and that's part of the reason that he presumably went out of his way to save Obamacare, even though Justice Kennedy sided with the conservatives, especially on the individual mandate. And so because of that, that to me is a big red flag that he has that reputation of working across the aisle and wanting to work with the, you know, quote-unquote other side. That should be something that is of concern to us. Another thing kind of along those same lines is he set the precedent for referring to the Obamacare fees as taxes. So you remember when it came to the fees and the other things that were involved with the individual mandate, when it came to Obamacare, for example, if you didn't have any kind of health care at all, they could actually fine you for not having any kind of insurance. Well, the way that Justice Roberts sort of justified that and said that it was constitutional is he started referring to it as a tax, not a fee. And when that happened, when that took place, the issue that you ran into is that even though he had no reason to say that it was a tax, he was essentially looking for a way to save Obamacare. But a lot of people are pointing to it's possible that it was a decision made by Brett Kavanaugh, who was the first person to refer to the fees in Obamacare as taxes. A lot of people are looking at that and saying, well, Kavanaugh is actually the place that Roberts got that idea. He was the first person to do so even before Justice Roberts did. So that to me is very concerning, that it was almost like Brett Kavanaugh was looking for a way to save Obamacare, just like Roberts. And part of the reason that I'm scared that he will become another Roberts. Also, there was a case known as Priest for Life, where he said that the government had a compelling interest in providing contraception. Now, granted, he came down on the right side of that case, so I don't want to be overly critical, but he did say and left some wiggle room here, which I think is dangerous. He said that the government did have a compelling interest in providing contraception, which is there's no easier or nicer way to say it, which is ridiculous. There is absolutely no compelling interest for the government at any level, federal, state, whatever, to provide contraception. Now, if an individual state wants to do that, for example, California wants to just hand out birth control left and right, well, that's their business, and I'm not going to say anything about it just because I don't live in California. I don't really care. I could say whether I think the idea is good or not, but as far as having some say into it, I don't have any say in it. I don't really want to have any say in it. But when it comes to the federal government especially, the idea that the federal government has some kind of compelling interest in making sure that people have birth control, that just, I don't understand that at all. I do not understand for the life of me where he got that or how he got to that conclusion. Now, one thing that is also really problematic is he granted standing to an atheist who tried to sue the Fed over the Pledge of Allegiance. Now, for those of you who don't know what standing is essentially saying that you have a, when a judge looks at whether or not standing has been established, they're trying to figure out whether or not you have a compelling reason to sue or to bring a case before the court. And when it comes to this, when it comes to standing in this case, usually the traditional way to decide that on cases like this is that you have to figure out some way that there has been injury inflicted on the person. I'm sorry, but I do not understand how you could get to the point where you say, okay, because this guy is an atheist and because he happened to overhear people saying the Pledge of Allegiance, which includes the words, one nation under God, that is compelling reason enough for him to be able to sue the federal government and for his case to be heard. I do not understand how injury was inflicted upon the person because of that. So he seems to be kind of fast and loose with standing on that. And that gives me a little pause, especially when it comes to religious liberty, when it comes to Kavanaugh and how he'll, you know, how he'll write opinions on that kind of thing. There was also a case called Garza, where he did not join a dissent that specifically criticized Roe v. Wade. He did join a different dissent. He still ruled correctly on that case. And by the way, that case had to do with an illegal immigrant and whether or not illegal immigrants have a right to an abortion, which, to me, I can't believe that that case, even in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, wound up going through. The idea that an illegal immigrant, somebody who's not even a part of this country, has a right to an abortion, it makes absolutely no sense. I don't think anybody has a right to an abortion, but especially not somebody who is a citizen having a abortion paid for by the federal taxpayer. Now, again, I'm not super familiar with this case. I only skimmed it because there's a lot to go through with these new Supreme Court nominees. But one thing that was a little odd in that is he joined a dissent that didn't directly criticize Roe v. Wade, even though he criticized the decision of the court. So he could have joined a much stronger dissent where it actually said that Roe v. Wade itself was flawed. He chose not to do that. And so that was a problem and kind of a red flag for me on cons. There's some conservatives that are saying that that's not a big deal, that people are making too much out of it. I don't think that you can make a big enough a deal about that. Now, does that mean that he's going to be like Justice Kennedy, that he's going to be for abortion even though he's conservative in other areas? I have no idea, but it certainly is a red flag because, again, like I said, he openly praised the original dissent that was written in the Roe v. Wade case, so maybe he is against Roe v. Wade. But in that particular case, he had the option to join one of the opinions there, and he decided to join the opinion that was less harsh, or that was not harsh at all towards Roe v. Wade versus one that was. So, I don't know. To me, that seems a little suspect. We'll talk a little bit more about this because there's some pros and cons, but there's also a handful of unknowns. And one thing that is kind of strange is he thinks that presidents ought not be under investigation while holding office. He said this back in 2009. A lot of liberals really lost their minds over this comment because they think that the reason that Trump picked him is because he said that he didn't think that presidents should be under investigation while sitting in office. Look, to a certain extent, I understand why they're concerned about that, because if that is the one thing that you talk about day and night is about the Trump investigation, which, again, it doesn't seem that it's going anywhere, but nonetheless, if that's your concern night and day, and I wouldn't put it past President Trump to pick somebody based on that, to be honest. But in 2009, what he was specifically saying is he understands the logic of not putting a president under investigation, because any president, regardless of what side of the aisle they are on, will be less effective as the president if they're having to worry about that on top of their already very stressful job. Makes sense. Don't necessarily agree with his conclusion, but it does make sense. There's a system of reason and logic behind that. Now, keep in mind, he said this in 2009, very early in President Barack Obama's presidency. So presumably it was not because, quote unquote, his guy was in office. And he also participated in the Ken Starr inquiry into what happened with Monica Lewinsky with Bill Clinton. So I think you're hard-pressed to say he doesn't believe that any investigation, if a president is doing something wrong, is merited just because the guy is the president sitting in office. I think that because of his involvement in that case, it's very, very hard to make the case to me that he doesn't believe a president should ever be under investigation when in office, ever. So that being said, I think that at least some of the concerns there are somewhat unmerited. When it comes to the contraception and pledge cases that we just talked about, that gives me a little pause on how he will be on religious liberty. But he also rejected cases about the presidential oath using the word "so help me God" and some contraceptive mandates. So on religious liberty, I don't know. He seems to be kind of a mixed bag. Maybe he'll be stronger when he hears more cases about this on the Supreme Court. He probably will if he winds up sitting on the bench. And when it comes to the issue of life, which is the most important issue when it comes to selecting a judge, he seems pro-life, maybe not uber pro-life or as strong on pro-life as Judge Gorsuch or Judge Thomas, but he seems in general pro-life. So that leaves me room to be optimistic. Again, there are a couple red flags when it comes to him on abortion, but overall, if you're looking at his opinions on it, I think overall he looks like somebody that is pro-life. He may be a little too sympathetic towards the pro-abortion movement, but I don't think that he's going to be somebody that is a Justice Kennedy, just based on what I'm reading on him so far when it comes to the issue of life. So that's really my breakdown of it. We'll talk about this in just a second and talk about one of my favorite things about the night was how the left reacted to this whole thing. So we'll talk to you in just a second. 860-1440. We will be right back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
I am a Christian in the only sense in which he wished anyone to be. Sincerely attached to his doctrines in preference to all others. Thomas Jefferson.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com, 860-1440. That's the number if you want to get in touch with us. And a couple things that I wanted to mention here. The left's reaction to this whole thing was just absolutely hilarious. Watching the protesters outside the Supreme Court freak out. Here's the thing that's funny about this. They would have been against anybody regardless of who Donald Trump picked. Not because they dislike the pick itself, because he's Donald Trump. I mean, you can tell that based on the way that they had they were out there protesting, even though they had no idea who the nominee was going to be. And when you listen to the speeches and you listen to the things that were said at the protest outside, these people, you can tell, were writing generic speeches that were inspecific to candidates. They were essentially speeches that were anti-Trump, not speeches that were anti-Brett Kavanaugh, because they didn't know that Brett Kavanaugh was going to be the nominee at the time, which goes to show that they were going to oppose the decision regardless of who it was. They were protesting because they hate Trump, not because they dislike Brett Kavanaugh. Now, they may dislike Brett Kavanaugh now, but they had no idea who he was or what he stood for ahead of time. There were some anchors, there were some people on CNN watching their coverage of it, where I gotta say, it was really hilarious. Jeffrey Toobin has been absolutely inconsolable since Justice Kennedy decided to step down, and because of that, and because of what was going on there, it's just funny. I actually had a bet going on Twitter whether or not we were going to see Jeffrey Toobin cry, and I think if we had nominated Amy Barrett, we probably would have seen Jeffrey Toobin break down in tears live on CNN. That didn't happen with Brett Kavanaugh, but he held it together, I have to say. So props to you, Toobin, for not breaking down and crying uncontrollably. So the idea, though, that is behind all this One thing that was funny is they were terrified that they were going to see this massive shift when it came to Obamacare. And that doesn't make any sense because John Roberts is still on the court. He was the one that voted in favor of saving Obamacare. It wound up being Justice Kennedy that was against it. And so I understand them being concerned on some issues, like even though I disagree with their position, obviously, I understand them being concerned that Roe v. Wade is going to be overturned. But when it comes to Obamacare, as long as Roberts is on the court, that concern doesn't really make any sense. So it was just doom and gloom, woe is me, pretty much all of the coverage that we were seeing on the media last night. And what this really all goes down to, because if they were to overturn Roe v. Wade, it would not be outlawed immediately. What would happen is that decision would go back to the states. And that goes to show that their principle when it comes to decisions on the judiciary is, will it affirm my policy preferences? That's really what it goes down to. Not will it defend the Constitution, will this person go along with my policies? Hour two coming.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
Alabama Supreme Court staff attorney Ben Dupree joins me right now to discuss Trump's pick for the Supreme Court. We go there right now on Tactics. Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, that's the way to get in touch with us if you have a desire to do so. You're also welcome to tweet us at Tactics Radio, and you should especially consider doing that if you want to ask a question of our guest that we have in studio with us right now, Ben Dupree. He is you are currently or were a staff attorney for the Alabama Supreme Court.
Both. Currently with Justice Tom Parker, previously Chief of Staff for Chief Justice Roy Moore.
Okay, and of course Tom Parker is he's running for the Chief Justiceship right now.
That's right. He just became the Republican nominee in June. We'll be running against Bob Vance in November. So we're hoping he becomes Chief Justice in January.
All right. Well, certainly great to have you in this morning. Glad to have you with us, and we appreciate you coming on the program. Now, I think you're one of the sharpest legal minds in the state of Alabama, personally. I've always appreciated your opinions, your legal analysis, and so that's part of the reason that I wanted to bring you in. Just before we get into some of the, I guess the best way to say it, to be in the specifics, in the details, what's your overall opinion of Brett Kavanaugh?
Well, as we were discussing off air, he's a decent pick from a good list. He's not the best pick, in my opinion, and I think a lot of the far-right conservatives, which we would count ourselves friends of, would agree. I saw Tony Perkins last night say, and I would agree, he's not Judge Barrett, who was probably my preference, but he's a good pick. He's a safe pick, I think, politically. Mm-hmm. There are some concerns we have based on his record, but he does have a substantial record that we can look at, so that's a benefit. I don't think we have a sleeper liberal like we had in Souter, that was appointed by a Republican. The concern is whether he's going to slide more towards a Justice Kennedy. Will he be more like a Justice Roberts, who has some issues? As we know, he upheld Obamacare. So I think he's not going to be a definite Justice Thomas. Could turn out to be like Gorsuch, which would be great. May actually end up more like Roberts. That's probably the safe prediction right now.
Yeah, I was kind of in the same boat and was thinking he might wind up being very much in the line of Roberts. The way I described it is I think he'll be slightly more conservative than Roberts, but slightly more liberal than Alito. And I think that that's probably where he'll fit into the court as far as
right.
Where where we would rank him on the scale of being a constitutionalist. But one of the things that I wanted to bring up that really confuses a lot of people. I found a lot of references to Brett Kavanaugh referring to himself as a textualist, but I couldn't find any of him talking about being an originalist, which gave me a little bit of concern. And I know that those two things are linked, most textualist or originalist and vice versa, but if you could just kind of explain for the audience some of the nuances, some of the differences between the two and exactly what that might mean for, hopefully, Justice Kavanaugh.
Well, first of all, this is great that we're even having this discussion. What a textualist is and what an originalist is in the context of a nominee to the Supreme Court. So it just makes me thankful that we're not dealing with a Hillary Clinton appointee here.
Who would never even enter the conversation.
No, it would be a Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Elena Kagan who have no regard for the words of the Constitution because it doesn't serve their leftist policy initiatives. So an originalist, we'll start there. And I will say Kavanaugh, in a speech I was just mentioning to you, praises Scalia and gives Scalia credit for basically bringing textualism and originalism back into our conversation. And I think he's right. Scalia has been was one of the main champions on the court. Thomas, I think, does it a little better and a little more principally. He's just not as loud and as fun to watch. So Scalia is the entertaining one, and he was very charming. He really never had any enemies personally, and he was able to bring almost single-handedly originalism and textual analysis back into the forefront. And so now I'm glad we're having this conversation. That's a win right there. So what is originalism? Originalism is primarily in the context of when you're looking at the Constitution, you take the words of the Constitution as they originally were meant by those that wrote it. Okay, so if you wrote a book 200 years ago, it would be inappropriate for us to take the definition that Merriam-Webster.com has for the words that you used. It would be more appropriate to go back in time, look at the contemporary dictionaries, and there were dictionaries at the time, Samuel Johnson's, Noah Webster's, and we can look and see what literally did they define those words as, and then also how did the people use them. The Constitution was debated in the newspapers. We call it the Federalist Papers now. So we can look at what was the vernacular then. What did they mean by establishment of religion? That had a very specific meaning.
So, militia is a great example, one that we think of very differently than our founders.
Yes, under the Second Amendment. It meant the people, as you know. And so rather than saying what in 2018, and we don't even know what male and female means in 2018, so we want to go back in time, as it were, to at the time of the ratification of the Constitution, when these words were put before the people, what was the meaning of them? That's how you interpret the Constitution, not by the modern spin that Justice Ginsburg has imagined or that Justice Kennedy has found deep in the cosmic meaning of human life. But it's what did James Madison mean when he wrote it? What did Fisher Ames and George Mason mean when they drafted the First Amendment? And then study what did the people understand it to mean? They're the ones that ratified it. It's not some secret committee of drafters. It's what did the people ratify when they said, yes, we want these first 10 amendments in and then the other amendments and the whole Constitution itself. So originalism, in brief, means the original meaning of the word. So it's similar to textualism because you're starting with the words and giving it the original meaning. Now, textualism is even almost a little more strict because it doesn't first go to the context and the meaning of those words. It just starts with the words, and that's usually used in a statutory interpretation. You're not dealing with the Constitution per se. You're dealing with a statute which was passed more recently, so you have more of a modern meaning, and you start with the words, which sounds, you know, like, of course, what else
right,
do you
like
start
a no-brainer,
with?
Yeah. But there are a lot of justices that don't subscribe to that.
There are justices that start with, well, what did they mean when they passed the bill? And they'll look at what Representative so-and-so said and what Senator so-and-so said, which is largely irrelevant because what's important is what they actually voted on in front of them on paper. And that's what actually gets put in the legal in the code for us to apply to our lives and to follow. We're not following what comments were made on the floor of the House or the Senate. We're following what they voted on, what the president or if it's the state, the governor signed into law. That's what we're bound by. So textualists start with the text and almost don't go beyond that unless the text is ambiguous. If it has two reasonable meanings or more, then we start to go outside and look at the context. We look at what did they intend for this bill to do or this passage to do. We look at it in the context of other provisions of the same statute, etc. There's certain rules you still need to follow, even if you step outside of this specific sentence or this specific provision.
Right, and when it goes to textualism, a couple examples that are pretty recent that I think that we could kind of look to is Trump's travel ban, for example.
Yeah,
The lower court kind of looked at it and said, well, it isn't a Muslim ban in the text of the law, but the president called it a Muslim ban, and there was some comments that, you know, necessarily not a lot of people would have agreed with, but, you know, Trump, he's not very specific in his language.
They literally argued his tweets.
Right.
Trump's tweets, which, of course, is the main feature of Trump's presidency and
right.
candidacy. They actually tried to pull his tweets in and make that relevant and illuminating this order, which I think is inappropriate, and the federal court agreed that you have to look at the order. What did the order say? Not what did Trump's tweet say about it after he signed the order.
Right, exactly. And sort of the opposite of that, not looking at textualism and not following with it, would be the Obamacare case, where they basically said, well, yeah, it says taxes, it says fees, but they meant taxes.
Right. And this is what Chief Justice Roberts held, that this was actually a tax. The government didn't even lead with this argument. Obama's administration actually kind of threw that in as a secondary argument. But that's what Roberts latched onto.
Mm.
That is one of the concerns we have about Kavanaugh.
Right, because he said the same thing.
He danced to the same tune. He didn't quite land on that as a holding below, but he did kind of deal with that same kind of theory. And so some people are saying, well, he set it up for Roberts to rule that way. So that's why we have there are some concerns about Kavanaugh. One of them is how he read Obamacare and kind of teed it up for Roberts to do what he did.
Okay, so we have Ben Dupree here. He works with the Alabama Supreme Court, and we'll be back with more with him, talk about some of the implications of the Supreme Court and what this decision, how this is going to shape the Supreme Court, you know, possibly for years to come, possibly decades.
Yes.
So we will be back with more with Ben Dupree in just a second. 860-1440 if you want to weigh in.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Galatians 5:1. It was for freedom that Christ set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440 is the way to get in touch with us if you want to talk about what's going on with the Supreme Court pick by Donald Trump. Of course, that announcement coming the other night. It is going to be Judge Brett Kavanaugh of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. And we have in studio right now Ben Dupree. He is a staff attorney for the Supreme Court of the state of Alabama. So thank you so much for being here, Ben. And I know that we have sort of been geeking out here because I'm a huge nerd when it comes to this stuff, talking about the differences in originalism and textualism. And so I did want you to go into a little bit more detail on this as well, because I already explained it a little bit to my audience. But Brett Kavanaugh is kind of known for being a critic of Chevron deference. So if you could real quickly sort of explain what Chevron deference is and why that is important for a Supreme Court judge.
Yeah, I found a speech of Judge Kavanaugh's that he's given in several contexts. This particular one was at, interestingly enough, Notre Dame Law School, and he begins by praising Amy Coney Barrett before I think she was appointed to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. And he talks about Scalia, and he does talk about the Chevron Doctrine, but I wanted to quickly give his synopsis of Scalia's view of textualism and originalism.
Great.
Here's what he said.
Yeah.
What did Justice Scalia stand for as a judge? So this is a speech just last year by Judge Kavanaugh. Mm-hmm. It's not complicated, but it is profound. The judge's job is to interpret the law, not to make the law or make policy. So, read the words of the statute as written. Read the text of the Constitution as written, mindful of history and tradition. That's
okay.
A perfect encapsulation of textualism and originalism.
Hey, if he'll stick to that, I think that he and I will be good friends.
Exactly. So the extent to which he echoes Scalia and Scalia's take, he'll be an excellent justice.
Mm-hmm.
And he does point out, he goes on to say that these are not just important things for separation of powers and federalism, but he says, but they're essential to protecting individual liberty.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he really gets it, and that's what's important. I think, for the most part, his judicial philosophy, to the extent he follows in Scalia's footsteps, which he appears to really like Scalia, he may end up doing. So the Chevron Doctrine, it comes from a case by the U.S. Supreme Court that has had its fair share of criticism, including by Judge Kavanaugh. But Chevron deals with these massive administrative agencies that some call the Fourth Estate that almost run autonomous sometimes of Congress. Congress will set up, for instance, or the president, you know, the EPA, or just these humongous agencies, and then they run, and they sometimes run amok, and then they create the regulations, and that's where we have these just massive volumes of federal regulations. These are all put out by really non-legislative entities, which are these administrative agencies.
Right, and the most scary part of that is they can't be voted out of office.
They're not voted in. They're not even appointed by elected officials. Well, I guess the very heads of them are. So they generate all these regulations. Mm-hmm. A lot of them cripple business, and we're all supposed to be aware of them.
Oh, and by the way, while we're talking about the, just so you know, so our audience doesn't panic, if we go off the air, keep in mind that the FCC is one of these administrations. So if we go off the air, it's probably the FCC listening in.
So Chevron, and this is also from Kavanaugh's speech, says, quote, "We must defer to an agency's reasonable interpretation of a statute if the statute is ambiguous." So in other words, this agency takes the statute that Congress has passed. Mm. They then interpret it and put their own regulations to enforce that statute. The Chevron doctrine says federal courts, if the statute was ambiguous, will defer to how the agency reads them and how they read their own regulations. So there's what's called deference to these agencies interpreting and running with their own interpretation. So what's interesting is, as Judge Kavanaugh points out, you could have a panel of judges who all disagree with how a particular agency is interpreting, you know, say an energy policy or statute or the FEC statute, or the FCC statutes. But they have to defer to what the agency goes with if they find that it's ambiguous. So that's a huge hole, and it can be a real problem that even the federal judiciary can't rein in as long as they're going by the Chevron doctrine. So yeah. It has not been overruled by the U.S. Supreme Court. It's still in effect, and so Judge Kavanaugh felt bound by it, but he was also criticizing it and pointing out the problems that it leads to.
Right. I gave this analogy. It would be almost like in a football game if you had the referees actually on the staff of and paid for one of the universities when you came into their house. So, you know, it's people that are actually – we'll just use Auburn since that's my school. If Auburn University paid the referees and they were on the payroll for the for Auburn University, and they get to decide whether or not that was a catch or not and whether or not Auburn scored a touchdown, well, that's kind of a problem there, and you can see why there would be a conflict of interest in them being objective as to whether or not the agency – acted in accordance with the law.
Yeah, and it's important, and we have this in Alabama as well. Administrative law judges, they work for a particular agency, and then they sit in judgment over that agency's actions. So sometimes it can feel like you're getting homered, but they're supposed to be independent. Mm-hmm. But there's also supposed to be judicial review so that you can have an appeal to an actual judicial court in the third branch of government, not still in the executive branch or even the legislative branch. So, but Chevron even kind of shackles what the judicial review power is able to do there if they just defer to the agency's interpretation.
Okay, so we're actually coming up on a commercial break, so we're going to go ahead and take that now. And what we're going to do when we come back is we're going to talk about some of the importance of state courts and some of the lower courts in sending actual cases up to the Supreme Court for them to decide on, which can have a great impact on the whether or not the Supreme Court gets to have any say on certain issues, certain things. And I specifically want to talk about the issue of life in reference to that. So we will be back with more with Ben Dupree in just a moment. 860-1440 if you want to weigh in.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
The most effectual means of securing the continuance of our civil and religious liberties is always to remember with reverence and gratitude the source from which they flow. John Jay, first Supreme Court Chief Justice.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. The FCC did shut us down. Luckily, I have Ajit Pai, the commissioner, on speed dial, and he was able to put us back on the air. So I appreciate Ajit Pai getting back to us so quickly.
Kind of him.
Nice guy. Anyway, so we're here with Ben Dupree. He's talking to us about Donald Trump's Supreme Court nomination. And one thing that I know that you talked to me that you wanted to address, and I was fine with it because I do think that it is an incredibly important issue, is the role that state and lower courts, in other words, like federal appeals courts, that they play in the decisions that the Supreme Court actually hears those cases and then makes on them.
Yeah, so I mean, we tend to focus obviously when these nominations are made on the role the U.S. Supreme Court plays.
Sure,
but I think it's important to remind people how cases get up to the U.S. Supreme Court. They don't start there; they start either in state court or they start in federal court.
And the Supreme Court actually hears a surprisingly low number of those cases.
Well, yeah, they get to decide which cases to hear. So
right.
it ends up being under 100 cases that they actually issue opinions on. Mm-hmm. So there's two ways that cases get up to the U.S. Supreme Court. One is through the federal courts. That would include the court that Judge Kavanaugh sits on now, the D.C. Court of Appeals. So it would go through federal district court, then appeals court, and then if the Supreme Court takes it, up to the U.S. Supreme Court. But the other avenue that I wanted to focus on is the state courts. A case will go through trial, intermediate appeal, and then the Alabama Supreme Court, and then from there it can be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. And that's how we got cases like Roe versus Wade. It went through the Texas courts and then U.S. Supreme Court. It's how we got Lawrence v. Texas, where Justice Kennedy wrote that there's a constitutional right to homosexual activity. That came from the Texas Supreme Court, too. So don't neglect, while we're focusing on the U.S. Supreme Court, the role that, for instance, Alabama Supreme Court justices play, like Justice Tom Parker. And
right, and actually when he came here and we did the interview with him, he talked about that being something of the utmost importance, and I agreed with him that we need to have strong, bold opinions on that so that the Supreme Court can rule on them and not do so necessarily so narrowly, but actually right. give an opinion that makes a difference.
The Masterpiece Cake case is a perfect example.
Exactly.
The Colorado Civil Rights Commission did the wrong thing. The Colorado Supreme Court affirmed them doing the wrong thing. Up it went to the U.S. Supreme Court. So we'll have states doing the wrong thing. Let's have a state here in Alabama that where the courts do the right thing, because when you have splits like that from the state courts as well as the federal appeals courts, the U.S. Supreme Court is more likely to take the case. So we need bold conservative justices in the Alabama Supreme Court and the appellate courts to rule the right way, to rule as strong conservative constitutionalists. And they can also provide the foundation for the U.S. Supreme Court to rule the correct way, not just the right result, but the right manner and the right analysis. And that's what we're kind of parsing through just Judge Kavanaugh's writings. Did he came to the right result in most of these cases on
right.
life, on even on Obamacare, Second Amendment. He was really good. But we want to look at the tea leaves, as it were, of how did he get there? Did mm-hmm. he get there as more of a Roberts, or did he get there as more of a Scalia or Thomas? And it's kind of a mixed bag. Sometimes, sometimes he got there like Scalia or Thomas. Sometimes he got there more of a Roberts. He took more of a center right approach, as he's believed he should have taken. So those are the ones that we're kind of concerned with. I do want to point out that at the end of this speech that I was reading from earlier, he says,
sure.
"In sum, Justice Scalia believed in the rule of law as a law of rules. Chief Justice Roberts similarly wants judges to be umpires, calling balls and strikes, which ordinarily entails judges applying a settled legal principle to a particular set of facts. I agree with that vision of the judiciary." So again, if Judge
yeah.
Kavanaugh sticks to what he says in his own speech, and
absolutely.
He's given this speech more than once, then we're going to be really happy with a Justice Kavanaugh, I think.
Yeah, if he turns out to be an Alito, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, that's
I mean, I'd rather him be a Gorsuch, I'd rather him be a Thomas, but I'm fine with another Alito if that happens to be the case. But one thing that I did want to talk about, and we've kind of alluded to this but not talked about it much specifically, a lot of people, especially on the left, are freaking out that Roe v. Wade would be overturned. And I want specifically, because I think that there's some opinions that I've read of him that say that he's a very strong pro-life advocate. I know that one of the speeches that he gave some time ago actually specifically praised the dissent in Roe v. Wade by the Supreme Court. And so that does give me some hope. But there's also some red flags. For example, that case with the illegal immigrant saying that she had a right to an abortion, he could have joined the dissent directly criticizing Roe v. Wade. He chose to pick a different dissent to join with. So what do you think that he's going to do on the issue of life?
Yeah, so you already discussed the Garza case, am I right?
The illegal, I brought it up.
Alien abortion case. Yeah. So there was a more principled way to dissent, as it were. So if we're having our druthers, he could have been a little better than he was, and he conceded a little too much. He conceded what the government appeared to concede, that under precedent, the immigrant minor is assumed to have a right to abortion. Which is actually a fair argument or a fair point to be drawn from Supreme Court precedent. But I want to remind people that a judge does not take an oath to uphold Supreme Court precedent. A judge takes an oath to uphold the Constitution, including federal courts of appeals, including U.S. Supreme Court justices. And it's actually laid out in the Constitution and in the Federal Judiciary Act what their oath is. And it specifically is, because we're a rule of law and not of men, they do not swear to uphold Supreme Court opinions.
Right, and
that would be very troubling if they did. Just as we don't swear allegiance to a crown, we swear allegiance to the Constitution, judges included.
And that's one thing that is just, it makes me bleed at the eyes when I'm watching CNN or any of these other news networks where they'll have commentators on and they'll talk about, well, Roe v. Wade has settled law and it's been a woman's right for 40 years. Cecile Richards, the former CEO of Planned Parenthood, was saying that just last night. I was like, well, you know, slavery was settled law for 89 years. So are you suggesting that just because the Supreme Court has ruled on something that it can never be brought up, or that means that it is always moral, it's always the right decision? There is a allegiance to the Constitution, and whenever you have this conflict where something the Supreme Court has said previously, but that flies in the face of what the Constitution is saying, as a judge, you're supposed to side with the Constitution, not precedent.
Settled law has the same meaning as a watch on a preacher. It means nothing, okay?
And as a preacher, I can affirm that.
And that's why I use that, and I'm a son of a preacher. A watch will not stop a preacher from preaching, no matter what time it is. Settled law is a meaningless phrase. It's a litmus test that the left has invented to try to gin up opposition to people that they think they're not supposed to like. An opinion by a justice or a judge or a court is never law. It's an opinion on the law. The law is the Constitution. It's statutes passed by Congress. That's what the law is. The judicial branch does not issue laws. It issues opinions on the law. It settles legal disputes in cases by applying the laws to the facts of the case.
Right.
That's what it is. Settled or not, whatever settled mean, I don't know, but the court, it should overturn precedent in cases that are bad, that have gone against the Constitution. And so when I hear this phrase settled law, just remember, it's meaningless. It doesn't mean anything. It's not law. It's not settled. And I often use the example of Bowers v. Hardwick. Most people aren't going to know what Bowers v. Hardwick was, but it's what the court overruled itself 17 years later when they said in Lawrence v. Texas in 2003, oh yes, there is a right to homosexual conduct. Because in Bowers v. Hardwick in the late 80s, they had said, no, of course there's no right to homosexual activity and the states can make it illegal. Well, 17 years later, we thought it was settled law, so-called. The court reversed itself because it had discovered a new right by none other than our typical right finder, Justice Kennedy.
Right, and that's the thing. The left will talk about settled law, and they'll beat that drum as much as they can when it comes to things like Roe v. Wade. But when it comes to, for example, Citizens United, well, they have no problem overturning that.
That's not settled law. That needs to be overturned. So, yeah.
Which really means it comes down to what you were saying. When they say settled law, usually what they mean was decisions that I like.
What they mean is they need five justices to pretend a right exists because it's not in the Constitution. They require five justices to have a right to an abortion. They have to have it,
yep,
or they lose it, because it's certainly not in the text of the Constitution.
Well, and that's why
they're screeching about Kennedy being removed, because he was the one that wrote it for them and has upheld Roe versus Wade in the Casey opinion. He gave us the Lawrence v. Texas case, which then led into the same-sex marriage case, Obergefell, a few years ago. Mm. I mean, the man was a master at inventing things. He was the emperor who has no clothes. And the left relies on everybody else agreeing that the emperor's new clothes are just wonderful and beautiful and amazing when they don't exist. And so when someone comes along and says, like in the story, wait a minute, the emperor's stark naked. Because I can see that he's stark naked. So the left has to have justices to go along with their make-believe, or they have no more rights.
Well, and that's one thing. I was reading a article not long ago, I think was it an, I think maybe it was a CNN opinion piece, and it was talking about the legacy of Justice Thomas kind of in relation to all this. They were wondering if we were going to get another Justice Thomas as the appointment. And one of the things that they brought up is that Justice Thomas essentially came out and said that the child labor laws were not something that he would have, the decision that was made by the Supreme Court on labor laws was not something he would have approved of. And they tried to make him out to be some kind of monster that believes that children should be working. Just because a judge says that he disagrees with the way that a court got to a decision does not mean he thinks that the practice itself is moral. That's what they can't do. They cannot separate what the law actually says versus whether or not they think a practice is good or not.
Justice Scalia said a good judge will sometimes issue opinions he doesn't like.
Yeah.
And that's hard for, you know, conservatives to swallow sometimes, too. We look at what was the result, what was the result. A lot of times, the answer is not what we wanted. You know, the answer is, and Scalia actually took this tack on the pro-life issue.
Mm-hmm.
He thought Roe versus Wade was an abomination and needed to be reversed. But he didn't go so far as to say that, for instance, the 14th Amendment protected the unborn affirmatively as a right to life.
Well, another decision, the flag burning.
On that. Yeah, flag burning.
Which Scalia agreed with the left on.
That it was a violation of free speech to criminalize flag burning. So, you know, the left, they're masters at this of unfairly taking a, you know, and they're, notice they're not engaging Justice Thomas on the legal question. Like, point out how he's incorrect on the law. They don't do that, and they do that with a lot, mostly conservative judges. They just attack them personally, say he doesn't care about children, which I find ironic for people that are pro-abortion.
I know.
And so they just smear the man's name, but that's what they're going to do with Kavanaugh. But I don't think it's going to stick, and I think that's why Trump probably picked him. He's a safer pick. There's nothing for them really to get their claws in. He's never been very vocal against Roe versus Wade, although he's kind of hinted that he doesn't like it, but we're not sure. So
yeah, and I
the
was
things
tweeting
that you and I are kind of like about the left, it kind of takes away some of their steam and fire.
No, that's true. And one of the things that I was tweeting about last night, because I knew that this was not going to happen, but I said that politically speaking, it would be much wiser for the left to just go ahead and confirm him quickly, because I mean they're not going to get a less. But they're not going to get a more moderate justice than Kavanaugh, really. I mean, Kavanaugh was about as moderate a justice as they could have hoped for.
They're probably secretly, you know, breathing a sigh of relief. They're never going to admit to that because they have to fundraise for the midterm.
No, because they got to stir up the base.
Exactly. So they're going to stir up the base. Schumer called him. He said he couldn't think of a more divisive candidate. I mean, so if Schumer's
what?
If Schumer's talking,
Schumer's on some good weed.
He's lying. well, he's from New York, so you know, grace to him. They're going to go through the motions, but I am hopeful that Trump is saving a Judge Barrett for the next one. If Judge Ginsburg finally moves on in whatever way,
hopefully retirement.
Hopefully really soon. I hope then Trump will step up with what would be a bigger fight, admittedly, a Judge Barrett. But I have no reservations about a Judge Barrett. And you and I share some reservations about Judge Kavanaugh. We're kind of cautiously optimistic. I hope he does follow in the lead of Scalia, whom he does seem to champion.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ben, for being with us. We're about out of time. I got to go to my chaplain's report, but really appreciate it. Ben Dupree, staff attorney for the Supreme Court of the state of Alabama. Again, I think one of the sharpest legal minds in the state. Really appreciate him making some time and coming in with us. Thank you so much for being with us. And we will be back. Chaplain's report is up next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Philippians 3:20, for our citizenship is in heaven, from which also we eagerly wait for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440 is the way to get in touch with us. Chaplain's report this morning comes from the book of Romans 13:8-10. And just to give you a little bit of a setup here, you have to keep in mind that the person who is writing Romans is the Apostle Paul. The Apostle Paul is, by his own description, a Hebrew amongst the Hebrews, a man of the tribe of Benjamin, a member of the Pharisee, the most strict religious sect of the Hebrews in his day. And so this is a man who knows the law of Moses. And I thought it was appropriate to talk about this since we've been discussing this morning how important it is to have the law, to know the law, to understand what it says, and to do the best that you can to follow it to the letter of the law. This is a sentiment that is shared in the scripture. And that makes sense because what we've been talking about with the originalism and textualism, the same principles actually do apply to the Bible. If you want to follow the Bible, you want to do what the Bible says, you have to understand it in the way that the people that it was originally written to would have understood it. That gives you a better, fuller understanding of the message that is being conveyed here. And with that in mind, let's look at this and remember that Paul is coming at this from the place of somebody who knew the law of Moses intimately, who was very familiar with its precepts. And he's giving advice to people, both Gentiles and Jews, at the Church of Rome here about how to follow the law of God. He says in Romans 13:8, "Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another, for he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. For this, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet. And if there is any other commandment, it is summed up in this saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law." See, Paul gives a great summary here of what the basis of all the laws are. He says, you're not supposed to steal, you're not supposed to commit adultery. Why are those things important? Because all of those things are a lack of love for your fellow man, a lack of love for a fellow creation and an image bearer of God. Somebody that God created, somebody that God loves, somebody that he cares about. If you ever have kids and you have more than one and they fight with one another, I know my parents talked to me at length about how much that hurt them because it was their children. Well, we're all God's children. When we mistreat one another by breaking the laws, that is a violation that God abhors. God wants us to love each other, and that's why the law exists. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.